From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan's rep on the Great Lakes Compact Council says it's too early to decide whether Wisconsin violated the compact by okaying a huge water diversion without an extensive public review. We'll hear from him. Plus, libraries respond to America's opioid crisis.
One day, someone came running up to the desk and said, "There's someone sick in the restroom." So she grabbed her cell phone and ran in there, and sure enough, there was this woman lying on the floor with a needle in her arm.
A comic book helps Native tribes reclaim ancestral remains.
For Anishinaabe people, it's so important for us to retrieve our ancestors.
And those lions.
Who are the lions? Are they the first two teams where they look so bad against bad competition? Or are they what we saw last night? They look so good.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In 2016, the Wisconsin city of Waukesha got permission to draw more water from Lake Michigan, 8.2 million gallons a day. That green light came after a long process and close examination under the terms of the Great Lakes Compact, the regional agreement among eight states and two Canadian provinces signed in 2008. It's designed to keep Great Lakes water inside the Great Lakes Basin. Well, now we learn in 2010, Wisconsin quietly approved a request from the city of Pleasant Prairie to divert an additional 7.49 million gallons of Lake Michigan water a day. And that approval came with no public notification. With us now is Grant Trigger, the designated representative for Governor Snyder to the Great Lakes Compact Council from Michigan. Grant, welcome. It's so good to have you on Stateside.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So just to recap, on Friday, we spoke with Peter Annan. He's the Great Lakes researcher and author who first made public this water diversion to Pleasant Prairie. And he told us states were required to report to the Great Lakes Governors Association a list of all the cities and towns getting water diversion so they could be grandfathered in and used as a baseline for future requests for more water. So here's what Peter Annan told us.
Wisconsin, in the grandfathering Pleasant Prairie, boosted Pleasant Prairie's water diversion from 3.2 million gallons per day to 10.69 million gallons per day based on anticipated future need. That made Pleasant Prairie the largest water diversion in Wisconsin, and nobody knew about it.
So, Grant, when and how did you first find out about this water diversion to Pleasant Prairie?
Well, the specifics with respect to Pleasant Prairie have only really been made apparent in the last few weeks with some of Peter's research. We're still evaluating some of the history because fundamentally, at the time the compact was passed, all of the communities that were diverting water at that time were permitted to continue to divert the water, and there was a process established to determine the amount of that water that was based on a different state's approach to it. Wisconsin's approach was different than Michigan's, for example.
So so I'm clear, you did not really know about this either until, and you're on the council, on the Compact Council, until Peter Annan's research shed light on this.
Well, let me put it this way. We have known about, and it has been a generally known issue, that all of the communities who were diverting water were grandfathered in 2008. The question about the amount of Pleasant Prairie's amount, however, was not questioned until recently. And so we're going to take a look at it, have some discussions with the other states, and determine if there's any basis for the concern that Peter has raised.
I think the question on people's minds is that when you think among Wisconsin state officials, the governor, your Wisconsin counterpart on the council, city officials from Pleasant Prairie, why didn't someone say something to the Compact Council?
Well, I guess I'm not sure what you mean by saying something to the Compact Council. Each state submitted a list of those communities which had qualified grandfather diversions. Those different lists were maintained and are maintained by the Compact Council staff. A question coming up about any one of those individuals, and there are thousands of these, by the way, if a question comes up, it warrants review. But we have no basis at this point to conclude one way or the other whether it's problematic or not.
I wonder if you've got thoughts about the spirit of the compact, that this news about the water diversion to Pleasant Prairie, how does it fit within what leaders had in mind when they drew up the Great Lakes Compact?
Well, I mean, that's a good question because there was a lot of focus on new or expanded diversions or expanded withdrawals, pardon me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Waukesha was. And if you look at the Foxconn matter, that issue came up with respect to existing capacity for the city of Racine because Racine was also a grandfathered community. Racine's a volume of diversion withdrawal was substantially larger than Pleasant Prairie, for example. So the fact that there is a grandfathered diversion in and of itself is not a surprise. It's not problematic. The only question here is whether there was a change in the amount, as I understand the question that's been posed, and I can't answer whether that was appropriate or not. As to the spirit of the compact, if there's any new or expanded withdrawal or diversion, there are certain standards under the compact that require notice to be given to the other jurisdictions, and those notices are shared by each of the states at different times, as Michigan has shared those notices when Michigan has identified a new withdrawal or a diversion. So I can't speak to whether this was or wasn't appropriately noticed because I don't have the background on it. That's what we're still reviewing.
How serious, Grant, from your point of view, is this? Can you give us some context just based on your work with the compact?
I'm not prepared to conclude that it's particularly serious or not because we haven't completed our review. If we find based on the review that there is something inappropriate here, we'll take it up. So I think in retrospect, Waukesha was very important. That was a full review process. There were issues across the Great Lakes Basin that were discussed by many stakeholders and many jurisdictions. So that one really, I think, got a lot of hearing. It was important because it was a potential precedent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether this is simply an administrative action of Wisconsin or whether it constitutes a precedent. And until that evaluation is done, I couldn't opine one way or the other whether this was problematic.
So what is next moving forward? What are the options?
Well, we'll have a discussion with the city of Wisconsin. We'll review some of the background information here. I mean, it's very possible that there isn't really anything of significance here if Wisconsin did it in accordance with their state law. And whether Wisconsin did it in accordance with their state law isn't something I can speak to right now because we haven't considered it yet.
Grant Trigger, the designated representative for Governor Snyder to the Great Lakes Compact Council from Michigan. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. And Tom Brady and the Patriots come to town, give Matt Patricia his first meeting with his old team and as head coach, and wonder of wonders.
26-10, Lions over the Patriots. I sent out several sarcastic tweets asking if my Comcast contract is not working because somehow the screen says the Lions are beating the Patriots. Is anybody else out there experiencing this?
Many people were saying things like that. What? Who, is this our Lions?
Is this sunspots? Is it?
And this was a resounding win. This wasn't just an eked it out.
It wasn't a fluke. They outplayed them on both sides of the ball. The defense was phenomenal against Tom Brady. Now, people are saying Tom Brady's getting old, but yeah, he's in the Super Bowl last year, so he's not that old. It is one of the freaks of nature is what I just saw.
Well, you stop and think. This was the same team that made just a disastrous showing against the Jets.
The Jets, who stink.
Less than 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
The Jets have won 5 games last year. They smoked the Lions.
Yeah.
The 49ers won 6 games last year. They smoked the Lions. And you're thinking, these guys look as horrible as they did in the exhibition games this summer. They've made no progress. And then out of nowhere, they pull about 8 rabbits.
So what do you think happened?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Well.
How can that team be the same thing? The joke was they swapped jerseys with the Patriots. That's how strange the whole thing worked. So I don't know what Patricia did this week. We were talking last week about maybe he'll have a short run here.
Yeah.
They look so bad the first 2 games, and there they are. So I don't know what it was, but whatever it was, if you're a Lions fan, keep doing it.
All right, we'll leave that there and head over to Saturday college football. So after this weekend, which group of fans should feel better about how their team is shaping up for the season, Spartan fans or Wolverine fans?
Answer's yes.
Okay.
Both of them. Spartans look quite good against a competitive Indiana team down at Indiana. A few trick plays in there and so on. A good, solid victory. Big Ten, hey, they count two, as they say. One win for you and one loss for them because you're all in the same division. So that's a very solid win for the Spartans to get back on track.
And then for Michigan-Nebraska, womp.
Best game they played in a long time. Nebraska's Nebraska. They're 0-3. I get that. But it's still a legitimate Big Ten team, of course, and Michigan was hitting on all cylinders. And you can just tell, talking to the guys after the game, how cathartic it was for them to play that well, to get that many guys in the game. Everything and absolutely everything worked.
Now, I really would like to get your thoughts on Tiger Woods finally winning a tournament for the first time since August 2013, and that is 1,876 days, if you're counting. What did you think as you saw that happen yesterday?
I thought that that guy is one of the best competitors I've seen in my life, that he's had countless surgeries on his left knee mainly, some on his right, his back. Swinging a golf club is one of the worst things you can do for your back, as any guy with back pain can tell you. And he's done it millions of times at full, at more power than anyone else ever swung a golf club. So to see him crawl back, and he has not got the same game he had before, I find the third act of an athlete's career the most interesting. When your fastball no longer pops at 101, when you got to start throwing curveballs and changeups and whatnot, well, Tiger Woods can't just outdrive everybody anymore. That's gone.
He's got to gut it out.
Got to gut it out. Got to get clever around the green. You got to be disciplined. Can't make double bogeys and so on. And what we saw was, in some ways, Tiger's finest hour.
And when you think of the personal issues he's been through...
Or he's created for himself.
Created for himself, absolutely. These personal issues, the humiliation. I think he'd slipped to, what, 1,999 in the rankings, something...
I might have been behind him, like, two.
And you stop and you kind of think, it could have been easy to say, you know what, forget it. Forget it. I'm done.
He's got piles of money. He'd make more piles of money
right.
Designing golf courses or endorsements, whatever else. He could have very easily walked away, which shows you the heart of a competitor and why you have to come back. Now, he's still four major titles away from Jack Nicklaus. He's got 14. Nicklaus has got 18. Now, 10 years ago, we're all thinking, how far past Jack Nicklaus will he go? And now he's been stuck at 14. He's been close this year. But that race is now back on. And like I said, this might be his most endearing phase.
And so young athletes can take some lessons from Tiger.
Look, his line years ago, if you don't have your A game, you got to grind it through anyway. And a great line I often quote here from Steve Martin, the comedian. He said, on any given night, it's not that hard for a decent comedian to kill it. You know, the crowd's with you, you're reasonably funny and all this stuff. He said the hard thing to do, and what separates the pros from the so-so ones, is you got to be good, not great, but good every night no matter what. You got a cold, the sound system's not that good, the crowd is not into it, and you got to find a way to make it work for a solid hour. And that is what Tiger Woods has just done. If your A game's not there, make it work anyway.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator, John Eubankin. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Much more ahead on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. She may be very busy with her double major in mechanical engineering and engineering physics, but Kettering University student Ruth Willett always finds time for her passion, amateur radio, a.k.a. ham radio.
Kilo Mike for Lima Alpha Oscar from Echo Mike 82. Echo Mike 82.
Seneca, North Carolina, Fox Mike 0573.
Two South, thanks.
Yes, even in this era of FaceTime and Skype, Willett is doing her best to fire up enthusiasm on campus for amateur radio. I talked to Ruth Willett earlier this year about her passion for this old-school technology and asked her to start by explaining just what amateur radio is.
So amateur radio is an exciting service and hobby that allows you to have two-way communication really anywhere in the world. So when most people think of radio, you know, you're thinking of like AM or FM radio that you just can listen to. But radio is really a lot more than that. It really allows you to have communication anywhere. And amateur radio is a set of bands that are in the radio spectrum that are dedicated specifically for amateur radio operators who have passed the FCC license. And once they pass a license and they're eligible to get on the air, they can talk around the world using this mode of communication.
And when and how did you discover amateur radio?
I got interested in amateur radio because I wanted to learn Morse code. I'd always been kind of interested in it, and it really piqued my interest when I started learning about World War II in high school. So I started teaching myself some Morse code, and I mentioned it to a friend one day, and they told me that if I got my amateur radio license, I could actually talk to people using Morse code today. So I decided to get my license so I could communicate using Morse code.
So it just kind of pulled you in. What did you like about it? Why did it catch your interest?
It really was a combination of there is such a amount of learning that you can do, because amateur radio, there's three levels of licenses that you can get, each one giving you an increased amount of privileges on the amateur radio bands. And each license requires you to learn more material, learn more about how radio works. And it was very fascinating to learn how that works. In addition, there's such a great amount of people that are willing to help you. And as soon as I got licensed, there was a community of people from around the world that were just so excited that I was an amateur radio operator. And they welcomed me, they mentored me, they encouraged me. So it's really a combination of just the always learning new things, new activities, as well as being connected with a wonderful group of people.
So give us an idea, Ruth Willett, of a typical session. Let's say you're at home, you've got your radio in front of you. What do you do and who do you talk to?
That's a very good question. So we have so many different amateur radio bands that have different characteristics according to what time of day it is, because the radio signals, they bounce off the ionosphere, and it really depends what time of day to see how far they go. So I really pick whatever band I want to talk on depending how far I want to talk. If I just want to talk around town, or if I want to talk to someone, say, in California, or if I want to talk around the world, say, to Europe. So I pick a frequency, and I sit down, and I either find someone I want to talk to that I can hear, and I give them my call sign. That's Kilo Mike 4 Lima Alpha Oscar. I give them my call sign to let them know that I want to talk with them. Or I sit down and I start calling CQ. That's amateur radio term for calling any station. And anybody else who's on the radio and wants to talk can call me.
And then what do you talk about?
Really anything. The weather, you know, what our radios are, what our job is. It's really open-ended. You can talk about really whatever you want. When you're on the radio, there's kind of two main tracks what people tend to do. You either tend to have the long conversations and really talk about anything under the sun, or you can do something called contesting, which is a fast-paced competitive event where you can test your skills as an amateur radio operator, as a copier, as how fast you can talk to people clearly and succinctly, and you can try to talk to as many people as you can in, say, 24 hours.
I'm interested, what's the most exotic place where someone's been you've talked to?
One of the most unique was I talked to someone operating maritime mobile on a cruise ship. And in terms of countries, I've almost talked to 100 countries, but I think one of the most exciting was talking to the Isle of Man.
That little dot in the Atlantic. We have, Ruth, seen times when the amateur radio community has really pitched in and helped in natural disasters. Case in point, Puerto Rico, right? How did HAMS help Puerto Rico?
That is correct. Public service is really a backbone of amateur radio. So there are amateur radio operators that are prepared to go and help when emergencies happen. They prepare, they have all their equipment ready, they train so that they know what to do when such things happen. So after the hurricanes last year, there was a number of amateur radio operators that were deployed. They took their portable equipment and whatever they needed to get on the air, and they went down to Puerto Rico. They helped both by just serving the community as well as giving the valuable communication so that there could be information coming to and from the island in those critical days after the hurricanes.
Now, I remember hearing about school amateur radio clubs when I was in school, back in the Stone Age in the 60s, but nothing about it when my kids were in school in the 90s and in the 2000s. And I understand you're looking to kind of revive Kettering's amateur radio club. When did that club start and how long has it been dormant?
That is correct. So there's been an amateur radio club at Kettering University off and on as far back as the 1950s, as far as I know. Because of Kettering's unique schedule where we are at, it's a co-op system where we're at school for 11 weeks and then we go work for an engineering company and then we come back to school. We go back and forth and the club's kind of been up and down depending on student interests and whatnot. So it's kind of went dormant, I think, about 10 to 15 years ago. But there still was like a couple antennas on one of our buildings, and the club call sign trustee who'd been involved with the club is still at Kettering. So when I got to school, I knew that there used to be a club there, and I knew I wanted to bring it back. So I started talking with the club call sign trustee, talking with other faculty members and students, drumming up interest with people around campus. And then I just worked through the club approval process from Kettering, and we got approval.
So do you have people signed up yet?
Yes, we do. We have between 10 and 15 members right now. we're working on that public support and getting advertising around campus. We're very excited that just last weekend we hosted a technician level amateur radio class. So that's the first level of amateur radio license. And it was open to the public and Kettering students. And we had a couple of students that came and got licensed. And we have quite a few more who want to get their amateur radio licenses when we do the class next time.
How has ham radio influenced your view of the world, of other countries?
It's really opened up my view of the world. It's very fascinating what you can learn about different people. And it's definitely made me a much better person, being able to have conversations and get to know people anywhere around the world.
So it's made the world a smaller place. So to people who say, well, why do we need ham radio? We can Skype, we can FaceTime. What do you say?
When all else fails, there's amateur radio. Amateur radio does not rely on the internet or anything besides a radio and a wire antenna and the ionosphere to be able to get signals out. So even when all other forms of communication are down, amateur radio operators can communicate. And it's really thrilling to have that knowledge and to explore activities within amateur radio that interest me, all along knowing that if an emergency happens, I can be ready to stand in and help pass communication.
Ruth Willett is a Kettering University student who's a double major in mechanical engineering and engineering physics. Ruth, thank you so much for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure talking with you today.
The opioid epidemic touches every facet of life in our country, in our state. That includes libraries, where administrators and staff are figuring out the best response if a patron has an overdose or someone appears to be under the influence of drugs. Kevin King is with us now. Kevin is head of branch and circulation services at the Kalamazoo Public Library, and Gail Madziar is the executive director of the Michigan Library Association. Welcome to both of you, and Gail, I'd like to start with you. Tell us, how has the opioid crisis touched public libraries in Michigan?
Well, it's impossible to miss stories of overdoses happening in restrooms and parking lots of public libraries, especially in New York, Philadelphia, and Denver. And there, we know librarians have been administering the life-saving Narcan on a weekly and sometimes even a daily basis. And unfortunately, libraries across the country have become a common site for those overdoses, and that includes Michigan. Kevin can speak to what's happening in Kalamazoo, but also Grand Rapids, Muskegon. Those are among the libraries that have been sites of overdoses in recent years. And luckily, in those cases, law enforcement officers responded quickly enough to administer Narcan before it was too late. But these libraries now train staff and stock the Narcan kits, as many libraries across the state are now doing.
And certainly we should remind everybody, Narcan is a very, very important drug in keeping someone alive who is overdosed on opioids, because it kind of blocks the action of that molecule, of that opioid drug. So getting Narcan in a timely manner is very, very important. And Kevin, the Kalamazoo Public Library and its branches have developed a proactive approach to identifying and responding opioid use and overdoses. Tell us more about that.
Well, we decided, like you said, to take a proactive approach to the crisis, and we've done that in multiple ways. First, education, making sure our staff understands what it looks like when an individual, a patron, is maybe experiencing an overdose or under the influence of an opioid. And then two would be to make sure they are getting the training in applying the inhibitor, the Narcan, to somebody who might be overdosing. Third, we have decided to be proactive in the community. I work with the Kalamazoo County Opioid Coalition. It's an organization in the county looking at the crisis in Kalamazoo County and trying to determine ways in which the public library can be a player and an advocate and a resource for people in the county to combat and eradicate the crisis.
So how do you think, Kevin, things are different now that library staff has been kind of trained in best practices and that you've been so active with this? How are things different now?
Well, I want to touch upon one thing first. I think that the rise of opioid overdoses in libraries can be attributed to the fact that people who are taking opioids, if they are in a public place where there's a lot of people around and they do overdose, they know that somebody will find them. Somebody will see them and possibly help to save their lives. In my research, that was what was being pointed to for the rise of taking these drugs in public places like the libraries. Your original question, how has the library responded to this and how has the staff responded to this? Well, they're better prepared because they have the information. They've gone through the training. We've just started to get a lot of our administrators and middle managers through the training. They recognize someone going through maybe heading towards an overdose. They see the signs. There's a lot of signs that you can recognize in an individual if they're beginning to pass out from an overdose. So having that information and being able to be aware of the situation around them has been extremely important. This is one of the things that we talk a lot about in the library and when it comes to customer service and what we call mental first aid. You know, how do we train our staff to provide the services of what people need when they come into the library? And one of those is making sure they're going to be safe when they're in our spaces.
Gail, give us an example of how important this is, something you've seen in a Michigan library.
Sure. Well, our president-elect, Kristen Shelley, was testifying at the Senate Health Policy Committee, and she told the story about how she worked in a library some years ago, and there was a regular patron that came in. She was a typical soccer mom. She had a 13-year-old and a 6-year-old, and they had been coming into the library for years. And one day, someone came running up to the desk and said, "There's someone sick in the restroom." So she grabbed her cell phone and ran in there. And sure enough, there was this woman lying on the floor with a needle in her arm. And she ultimately passed away because they weren't able to save her. And the whole point of this story is that it's not just, you know, drug addicts or street people who you might stereotypically think are going to be using drugs in a library. This woman was in a car accident. She had hurt her back and was in a lot of pain, and one thing led to another. So this is something that can affect just, you know, people that you and I know.
Kevin, you actually are relying on people that have experienced opioid use.
Yes, we're working with a local organization, the Recovery Institute of Southwest Michigan, to introduce a peer navigator program in Kalamazoo Public Library, which is bringing individuals into the library to help our staff identify patrons who are struggling with opioid addiction and to help steer them into the right services they need. And we're really proud of it. We're going to be the fourth library in the country with this sort of program, and we're hoping that it will help be one way to help tackle the issue in our community.
Gail, as you think about this response of administering Narcan, that has raised in the past concerns about liability. And I know GOP State Senator Margaret O'Brien has introduced Senate Bill 829. Would you tell us about that bill and what it might mean to libraries in Michigan?
Sure, yes. And that's how Michigan Library Association got involved in this important project. And SB 828 and 829 both provide immunity for libraries in a situation that could arise from providing the life-saving treatment. Attorneys right now are often recommending that the libraries not stock the treatment because they could be held liable. These two bills would allow libraries and library employees to purchase, possess, distribute, and administer in good faith an opioid antagonist without possible subject to criminal prosecution. And it just provides immunity to libraries similar to that provided to public schools. And we testified in the Senate Health Policy Committee. And as we were doing that, the committee was so concerned and they were so responsive that the chair decided that he would like to hold up those bills and either amend them or rewrite them to include any area, any public area, bus stations, parks, that kind of thing, so that people can feel free to help provide this life-saving drug and not feel that they would be held liable. Now, there's always the Good Samaritan law that would provide liability protection for you or me, but when it comes to the actual entity, for instance, the library, they're a quasi-governmental agency, and they don't have the same immunities as, for instance, a school. So we wanted to make sure that libraries were included so that library attorneys didn't feel that the libraries were putting their assets on the line in trying to provide this.
So this I can tell from what you're saying, you feel this is an important tool in making libraries a safe, healthy space for everyone, and also giving library employees the protection to be able to, let's say, administer Narcan if needed.
Right. It provides them with protection from civil and criminal liability. And that makes sure that libraries are more able to easily access and administer to opioid overdoses in and around the library, whether that's in the library itself, in the parking lot, wherever it might be.
Kevin, Kalamazoo Public Library has really been, as we say, very, very proactive in responding to the opioid epidemic. What is your message to libraries around Michigan?
Well, my message is you need to look into it, no matter what size of the community. The opioid crisis happens in the smallest towns and in the largest cities in our state. So being proactive, seeking out ways, setting up systems, getting the training, finding partners in your communities to come up with a process and a procedure to work with individuals, to get the Narcan in your libraries, and to train people how to apply the life-saving drug to make sure that you're keeping your people in your libraries safe and you are helping direct people, you know, beyond that into other services.
Speaking from the front lines of libraries' response to the opioid epidemic, Kevin King with the Kalamazoo Public Library and Gail Madziar, Executive Director of the MLA, the Michigan Library Association. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a federal law passed some 30 years ago required museums to return Native American remains to their descendants.
You would think, you would hope that the response would be, yes, how can we do this? What can we do? How can we work together to right this wrong? But unfortunately, that is not the case.
Today, thousands of human remains still are in museums. That story next on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All around the country, museums have some 300,000 to 600,000 Native American human remains in their collections. In 1990, a federal law was passed that required certain Native American remains to be handed back to culturally affiliated tribes or provable descendants. It's called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, known as NAGPRA. But by no means did this law result in all of those human remains being given back. Sonia Adelay and Shannon Martin were part of a team that came up with a comic book to explain the tribal repatriation experience. It's called Journeys to Complete the Work in Changing the Way We Bring Native American Ancestors Home. Adelay is an archaeologist and a professor of anthropology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she's a previous member of the National NAGPRA Committee and author of the comic book. She is Anishinaabe Ojibwe. Martin directs the Zeboing Center of Anishinaabe Culture and Lifeways. She's with the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe. And here is our conversation from earlier this year. Sonia, before the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act was passed in 1990, what avenues, what options existed for tribes trying to bring their ancestors home for burial?
Well, the main thing that they could do was try to develop relationships and talk to and make pleased to, really, museums that held their ancestors. There was nothing formal. There was no law by which they could make that happen. So it was that relationship that mattered. And as we know, that very often did not happen. That just was not the case, that they were able to bring their ancestors home.
I'd like to follow up on that as well. And prior to the 1990 NAGPRA law, our sacred sites, burial grounds, were still being compromised. They were being desecrated and excavated professionally through various universities or private archaeological firms were sent in to do this type of desecration. And prior to that, even into the 1930s, 40s, 50s, some of our mounds here in the Midwest were excavated, they were opened up, and they were roadside attractions where you could pay 5 cents or 10 cents to pull off the side of the road and look into an open mound, earthen pit to see burials of our ancestors.
Sonia, what did the law do? What did NAGPRA do?
Well, the law put in place several provisions that require people to consult with tribes so that they couldn't just simply, you know, excavate whatever they wanted to do. Now, that doesn't mean that those processes have stopped. What Shannon's talking about, for example, it's not that graves still aren't being excavated. They can be. And in fact, that's one of the things that we try to bring up in the work that we've done, which one of the important pieces of this is cultural affiliation. If archaeologists or state and federal agencies are required to consult they're able to determine who it is that they should be consulting with. And as Native people, we can think, well, you should be consulting broadly with anyone who may have an affiliation with those ones who are buried in a particular place. But unfortunately, it's up to them to determine who it is that they're consulting with that they think there could be a connection or affiliation with. So we'd like to see state, federal agencies, institutions consulting broadly. Otherwise, they could just say, well, there's no one who's affiliated with these peoples, so we're just going to go ahead and excavate. And so that's a really important piece of this puzzle, that we think about how connections and affiliations look today.
Shannon, in the belief sense, explain the importance of returning ancestors to Mother Earth. And I'm particularly interested in what is the last giveaway ceremony.
Well, the last giveaway ceremony for us is the gift of our vessel, our body, the experience that we walked on this earth that carried our spirit, giving that back to Mother Earth to honor her for all that she gave to us.
That's interrupted when somebody's remains are in a library or a museum.
Exactly. It's interrupted. And that's why for Anishinaabe people, it's so important for us to retrieve our ancestors. And it's work many of us do from different tribal nations throughout the Great Lakes. It's something we do every day. We work on this every day.
And this comic book that you've put out, it tells the story of the transformation of a museum that was very resistant to returning remains and traveling items, artifacts. And it was the University of Michigan's Museum of Anthropological Archaeology in Ann Arbor. So what happened when the university was approached?
Between 2005 and 2008, we were requesting the return from three sites here in Michigan that were within the Aboriginal territory of the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe of Michigan. Those sites were the Rivera Voss site, the Bussinger site, and the Young site. We spent nearly 3 years with a consultation documentation grant from the National Park Service. So this grant was able to fund us to assemble a team of experts like Dr. Adelaide, as well as tribal historians and spiritual elders, to come together to provide a justification. And we worked very diligently in researching and putting together our justification and providing the documentation that was needed under the law and through the consultation documentation funding. We presented the information, 2.5 years of extensive research by our team, and within 2 months we received a letter that rejected our claim, stating that the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe of Michigan has no contemporary or modern day, we feel no modern connection to these ancestors. So therefore, you know, the university has rejected your claim for repatriation.
Was that initial U of M resistance typical or atypical?
Unfortunately, that initial resistance is quite typical. You would think, you would hope that the response would be, yes, how can we do this? What can we do? How can we work together to right this wrong? But unfortunately, that is not the case. Very often, institutions think of themselves as the stewards over these types of ancestral remains and these items.
And so they feel we need to hang on to these. We can't see them scattered to the winds or whatever. We need to know.
Yes, in fact, and I'll give the example of the other case in the comic was with Harvard University. And one of the comments that we received from the institution was, well, we are a museum after all, right? It's our job to hold, to store, to keep. And I think there are other institutions and that are now leading the way to say, no, that isn't the case. There can be other roles for museums. And we see that with the turnaround of the University of Michigan.
Let's talk about that turnaround, because that's really the centerpiece of this story. Shannon, how and why did the university's attitude change?
Well, it changed because we had to force it to change. Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe of Michigan, with its tribal council and PR department, took a pretty firm stance that University of Michigan needed to hear from us, needed to hear our claim, because one or two individuals made the decision to reject our claim for the ancestors. So we decided to attend a Board of Regents meeting, get on their public commentary. Our PR director read a very impassioned statement to the Board of Regents, and we staged a press release and honor songs and elders saying and said prayers before we went into the Regents at the Cube. So the press was there. We released a statement. talking about what the University of Michigan had done to the tribe and its fair and unjust treatment regarding NAGPRA. And we hoped that one regent or two regents would feel our pain, feel mm-hmm. our hardship in trying to do the right thing by our ancestors, and one or two did. And things began to change. A committee was put into place to investigate the relationship between the museum and Michigan tribes and other tribes. And from that point on, the person who was in charge of the Great Lakes collection was removed from his responsibility, and things started to move.
And as you point out in Journeys to Complete the Work, the University of Michigan is now like leading the pack in terms of returning items and remains. If you've just joined us, we are talking about the Journeys to Complete the Work and changing the way we bring Native American ancestors home, all about returning the remains of ancestors to their tribe so they could be properly buried. I'm talking with Shannon Martin, who is with the Zebuwing Center. She directs it, the Zebuwing Center of Anishinaabe Culture and Lifeways here in Michigan, and Dr. Sonia Atelier, who's a professor of anthropology and an archaeologist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and author of the comic book. So you tell this story in a comic book. Sonia, why a comic book?
Well, actually, some of the base of what I do is community-based research, which is just sitting down, working with communities, and finding out the kind of scholarship that they'd like us to do as academics. And I did this work in Turkey at a 9,000-year-old site that I worked at called Çatalhöyük. And when I went into people in the local village nearby there, a little village called Küçükköy, and I talked with local people who are mostly farmers, I said, well, what kind of things would you like to do? How would you like to learn about this 9,000-year-old site that's literally in your backyard? And one of the things they had talked about was that they would like comics to learn about it. And it made a lot of sense in that way. They said they were for their children, but what was really interesting was there's a pretty low literacy rate in these villages. A lot of the girls and boys don't have the ability to go to school beyond third grade. So for adults to learn about the site, of course, I'm not going to hand them a scholarly published article or a book. Comics were the perfect venue. There's visuals, and then the text is fairly minimal. So I worked with one of the other co-authors of the comic, John Swager, who was the illustrator on that site of Çatalhöyük, and we came up with a whole series of comics at that site. So I always say I can't claim this idea. It literally came from people in these villages. And it was actually during my work on the National NAGPRA Review Committee where I saw tribes coming forward struggling with really trying and fighting to reclaim their ancestral remains. It just occurred to me on that committee that this would be a really powerful and useful way to kind of mobilize that knowledge, get the knowledge out there.
So, Sonia, who did you write it for? As you authored this comic book, who did you have in mind as your reading audience?
I had a whole range of people. I mean, of course, in my mind, I was thinking, well, it could be for museums. It could be for students. I was hoping tribal nations would find it useful. But this has found success actually beyond my wildest dreams. And I actually kind of joke saying, I wish my book or any of the other scholarly things that I've written were getting this much interest. Thousands and thousands of copies being ordered, people using it across the nation to teach NAGPRA in their classrooms. And I think that's fantastic, these kind of engaged ways of getting knowledge out there. It's amazing to see how much interest there's been, and international interest as well.
And there it is, NAGPRA Comics number one, right? So it means that there's more to come. What was it about the Michigan story that made this the perfect vehicle, the perfect way to tell the story?
Well, the Michigan story, it was a difficult journey at first. NAGPRA and the spirit of the work, when it's done in true mutual respect, consultation, it can transform communities, it can transform an institution, and that's what it has done. And we believe the ancestors have helped compel that transformation, because now we are working together with the museum currently on developing a black ash basket exhibition where we're going to share our collections, and students are going to work with the Zebuwing Center to design and develop that exhibition. We are also working with the Matai Botanical Gardens and with the museum and looking at repatriating ancestral heirloom seeds to try to grow them out and rematriate them back into our communities. There are some seeds within the ethnographic collections that are about 100 years old. So we would be possibly reintroducing some new food source ancestral seeds into the community. So, I mean, the opportunities that are beginning to emerge when we are working together with mutual respect are just endless, and it's exciting work that the tribes are doing with the University of Michigan now.
And late last year, there was a recommitment to the Earth ceremony, so the ancestors were brought home?
Yeah, we brought one site, the Gary site, home from the University of Michigan, and this was probably, I would say, since the adversarial relationship in 2005, 6, and 7, this was probably the fifth ancestral repatriation that we've accomplished together. And, you know, the work to effectuate these repatriations, it does take a long time because you're following a process, you're following a federal law. And this past repatriation was probably, we saw the largest delegation from the University of Michigan attend. About 20 people from U of M came up to Mount Pleasant to participate with us in the full day of ceremony and recommitment of these ancestors back into the earth.
Now, are there more to come?
There are more. We're about halfway done. The Michigan tribes working together under an organization called the Michigan Anishinaabe Cultural Repatriation and Protection Alliance. That alliance has been in existence since early 2000s. Late 90s, and working together with the University of Michigan, we're about halfway done. Their collections were extensive, one of the largest in the country. Just from Michigan, well over 1,600 to 1,700 ancestors were here and were pulled out of Michigan alone.
Sonia, when I think of that staggering number, that 300,000 to 600,000 Native American human remains, and that could be a conservative guesstimate, isn't it? Is having a prominent institution like the University of Michigan kind of at the forefront of this, will that help spread across the country?
Well, that's certainly the hope. And that's part of the hope of the comic, is that rather than to say, sometimes people have said, well, we can't give back these materials. It closes the door to research. That's what NAGPRA does. That's what repatriation does. It means the door is closed. We can't do any more research. And in fact, what we're trying to show with that comic, as Shannon was articulating, is that, in fact, this opens the door to research, but it's research that's done in a different way, work that's done in collaboration with tribes and in partnership, you know, things that matter, and they can make a difference in Native communities' daily lives. So hopefully an institution like the University of Michigan taking such a prominent leadership role nationally and internationally to show how this can be done. And look what it's done. It opens the door to these amazing research projects that are really and truly cutting edge.
I'm actually flipping through Journeys to Complete the Work, looking at you guys, your comic avatars. What was that like when you first opened this book and went, oh my word, here I am. Here's Shannon Martin, and what was that like for you guys?
It's amazing. It's humbling also, you know, for us to be part of the story and being featured in the comic, it is very humbling. But also, you know, it gives young people somebody, a face and a name and a real person to look up to say, hey, you know, if I'm looking at going into anthropology or archaeology or museum studies and doing this type of work and bringing my ancestors home, they have somebody that they can relate to.
Well, it's eye-opening. You don't have to be a museum person or a university person or a member of a tribe to read it and really, really have your eyes open. And we have put up the link so you too can view this comic book, Journeys to Complete the Work and Changing the Way We Bring Native American Ancestors Home. You can find it on the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. And we've been talking with Dr. Sonia Atalay from the University of Massachusetts Amherst and Shannon Martin, Zibuwing Center of Anishinaabe Culture and Lifeways here in Michigan. Thank you so much.
Miigwech. Thank you very much.
Miigwech. Thanks for your time and interest.
Before we go, this note, the show today featured some interviews that aired previously on Stateside. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joey Horan, and
Sarah Leeson. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.